anybody could get caught up in these laws. Not that anybody should, but everybody could, because there is always a possibility of a challenge to your racial identity. And then there might be some extended genealogical investigation through the courts to try to figure out who did your grandmother go to school with or church with. It was everywhere across the nation, too. It wasn't just a, you know, a Virginia story or a Southern story. It was from Maine to California. And I think the thing that maybe grabbed my attention most was way back in more than 20 years ago now. I had a phone conversation with Mrs. Loving, and I was just dazzled by everything about the way she remembered the story, the way she told the story, the voice she used. As you saw what I said in Dan Casey piece, I fell in love with her voice. And then I met her later, and I met all the kids at one time or another. So from this universal kind of thing, from time and space across everything to one specific individual and her family, it's just a stunning set of stories. And there are lots of other stories, but this one, you know, in the course of a lifetime, you spend time with somebody who's not someone you could have married under the old law, and you think, hey, what if?
Right. Do you think there's a lot of younger people today, Peter, that maybe just have a really hard time understanding this whole period of time, you know, with miscegenation and the whole bit?
Absolutely. About a decade or so ago, I published a book. Each chapter was designed to get at something that had been true only maybe 50 years ago. And every time out, it was something that was a response, in fact, to my students who just couldn't imagine a world constructed the way the one was that their great-grandparents grew up in, or even their grandparents, and sometimes their parents.
The Supreme Court decision in 1967, was that expected, Peter? I mean, it was unanimous, but was that expected, or did that sort of, was it something that sort of sent some shockwaves, or you know, did it just sort of kind of get us over a certain hump?
Well, there's two ways to come at that, I think. One is to look at what the lawyers hoped for and what they fretted about. And another is to look at more general across-the-land kinds of responses. If we start with the second one, the across-the-land, all the formal underpinnings of segregation had been taken down, right? The 64 Civil Rights Act, to take the most notable example, but Brown versus Board a decade earlier than that. The Supreme Court or Congress or the President or some combination had said these things must go. The one thing left 3 years after the 64 Civil Rights Act was interracial marriage. In 17 states, it was still a crime. Yeah, in a lot of states it was still, but on the other hand, you could see the tendency, and the courts were intervening and Congress was passing laws. But in fact, the lawyers were concerned when they took the case through the court system. Let's say that the Virginia Supreme Court upheld the original conviction, as it did, and told the trial judge, but you blew it on the penalty. You can't just suspend that sentence. It should have been prison sentence, minimum a year. Had the Supreme Court of the United States not taken that case, they worried that they might leave the Lovings in worse shape rather than where they were or better. Now, they were pretty confident by the time they argued the case. Now, several years had passed since 63, 64 when they got involved. Several years had passed, and they grew increasingly confident that they would win. But they didn't know what that would turn out to mean. It could just mean that the convictions were overturned, that that law couldn't be applied to this particular couple. It might not be a broad-gauge kind of thing that would wind up throwing out all those laws in every state, as in fact it did.
On some levels, and you've written a couple of books, on some levels also, Peter, is this a love story, too, about, you know, Richard and Mildred and all they went through and all they persevered?
It's absolutely a love story. At its core, that's all it is. In fact, the new film that's about to be released takes that approach. It doesn't worry about the legal issues so much or the broader context. It looks at two people in love and how committed to each other and their children they were. How nothing would deter them, and they would take whatever it took, but they would fight as hard as they could. And what's, you know, so there's two things. One, there's this extraordinary, unremitting love story. And then there's this really cruel universe that framed it, where they could be hauled out of bed and off to jail and think they're going to be sent off to prison for years.
You did some consulting on the movie, right?
Not really. I talked a bit with casting people. I had a nice conversation with the writer or director. I had what I consider a magical conversation with the woman who plays Mildred. And I talked with some of the actors as well, but I really didn't play any kind of sustained formal role at all.
Did you try to convey anything either to either to Jeff Nichols or Ruth Negga? I guess did you try to convey anything to them about the story?
Yeah, I talked with several people, certainly including Jeff Nichols. We had a very good conversation, and I came away. He came away from the conversation thinking I was going to be displeased with the movie because he had to move some pieces around or suppress some storylines and such. But I came away thinking, here's a guy who actually knows what he's doing. He knows what questions he needs to address, what answers he needs to supply. He's very much aware of what the opportunities as well as the constraints are with a feature film. So that it's not a casual, don't matter kind of thing. He tried to take the story pretty seriously, but then he had to create a good, compelling movie out of it. As for the actors, I remember telling the man who plays Richard, I said, you know, everybody says about him that he was really reticent, that he didn't have much to say. But when you watch him on film, because someone actually filmed them back in the 60s, that was an extraordinary part of the resources. He has things to say, and if he wants to say them, he will.
What do you want people to come away with, you know, when they see this film?
Well, actually, I think there are two stories. One is the love story. This is a couple who, while they run up against all kinds of obstacles to keeping their family intact and staying free doing it, this is a love story that any individual could model. This is how I want to treat my other half. This is how I want my family to function. As for the bigger picture, you know, it's what we talked about a moment ago about how this is unimaginable, and yet it was real 50 years ago. And it took this couple, it took Mildred Loving writing to the Attorney General of the United States and his office writing back and saying, no, we can't help you, but here are some people who can. It took two young lawyers who brought very different skill sets to the encounter, but between them, they were able to take this case all the way through the courts and get the result that everybody, both they and the Lovings, clearly wanted. So it's a question of love, it's a question of capability, it's a question of persistence. It's also a question of just dumb good luck, right? I mean, if they had tried to take this case 50 years earlier, let's say, or even 10 years earlier, they'd have come up empty. The court would have said, no, we're not prepared to take this case.